Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Justin Russell, and we are live. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, except for one minor technicality. We are live not from Shelley's Backroom, but we are live from the Sunshine State, the state that gave us the Chads, the state that made recounting a national pastime. Greetings from Melbourne, Florida. I am your host, JT Russell. With me, as usual, is our usual cast of characters, but some of them are out in Washington, D.C., some of them are out in South Carolina, but we're going to be getting to them in a second. In fact, let's go live to the phones right now. I believe we have Congressman Al Swift. Is that you on the phone?
I am at Shelley's. One of us actually made it here.
Al, how you doing, my friend? Greetings from Florida.
I am doing fine, and it's not sunshining here, so you've got the better of it.
I think I do. It's a balmy 72 degrees outside, and you know the heated pool, I think, will drop the will bring the temperature up to about 80, but we'll give that a shot later on. As he does every Tuesday on the phone with us live from Shelley's back room. He's the only one live from Shelley's on this show. Today is eight-term member of Congress, Emmy Award-winning broadcaster Al Swift. And also on the phone with us, we have Dr. Ralph Winnie, Vice President of the Eurasia Center and political pundit on all things Asian Pacific, which is going to be a big topic of what we talk about. Ralph, are you there?
I'm here. It's great to be with you guys.
Hey, Ralph. Thanks for joining us. Greetings from Florida.
Well, I'm in Hawaii. I'm sitting out by the pool. 35 degrees.
How come one of you is by a pool and the other one is by an ocean and I'm sitting here? Well, I'm by the gin, so it's all right.
Yeah, I was going to say, Al, this becomes less and less of a good thing for you. And usually with us also is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob is away from D.C. He is in locations undisclosed in parts of South Carolina that we all enjoy and love. But one of the things, it has been a busy day. It's been a busy couple of days here in Washington. Well, there in Washington. I got to stop saying here. But it's been a busy couple of days inside the political front. A lot's going on, but the big breaking news that I want to start off with today is the breaking news that's still developing out of the Korean Peninsula. It appears that while the South Korean military were engaged in an exercise that had been notified to the North Korean military, during their exercise, the North Korean military decided to launch a barrage of artillery shells into South Korea. The last numbers we've heard is that two South Korean Marines were killed, upwards of 20 civilians were injured, some critically. But this is a huge, huge escalation of military might. The North Koreans are really starting to kind of buff up a little bit, pound their chests a little bit. Ralph, I got to ask you, you know, with everything going on the Korean Peninsula, and how delicate is the situation on the Korean Peninsula? I mean, even before this, how delicate has been the situation? How delicate has the relations been between Pyongyang and Seoul?
Well, you're correct. I mean, this has been the heaviest attack since the Korean War, and it brings us one step closer to the brink of war. I don't think the North is actually trying to seek war by intention, but inevitably we're moving to almost a war by accident, something that is in effect spiraling out of control, and that should be our greatest fear. What has triggered all of this is Kim Jong-il is starting the transition of power to his youngest son. And many analysts have come out and said that he wants to use some sort of nuclear muscle as a way to boost his son's credentials with the military. So a lot of this has had to do with the succession plan for the son, and it's now starting to spiral out of control. I think both the U.S. and China are going to have to get very tough with the North Koreans, because this is only going to get worse. It's not going to get better.
Al, as your term in Congress and being around the military, being around Washington as long as you have, you've seen a lot of changes going on between the relationship between North and South Korea, and in particularly some of the icing or maybe a little bit of the thawing of the relationship between Washington and Pyongyang. Going back to your term in Congress, was the American government that much in the dark, or was Congress that much in the dark about it, what was really happening in Pyongyang? And what kind of sense were you getting while you were in Congress versus now as far as the North Koreans and what kind of a threat they pose? Al? Ralph, you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. I can hear you.
Okay, looks like we may have lost Al. Let's go back to you on this subject, because this is a definite escalation in tensions. And right before the holidays and in the height of the White House announcing a blueprint to possibly subdue our positioning in Afghanistan and in Iraq, what does the actions from Washington signal to Pyongyang, and is this a coincidence? Are they doing this because they know that it's right after a midterm election? Does Pyongyang view President Obama as maybe weak?
Well, I definitely think that they're definitely testing President Obama. If you look at the comments that Mike Mullen has said, North Korea is frankly a dangerous country intent on making nuclear weapons, and major powers are going to have to work to bring pressure on North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. And Obama has not done that. He's tried diplomacy, but that doesn't seem to be working. We are involving China in the six-party talks. I think China is a very key player because it's not in their interest to have North Korea going on this kind of tirade. It creates a lot of instability in Asia, which China is very worried about.
And it looks like we've got Al back with us. Al, how you hear us?
I hear you fine. I just dropped off. I'll probably do it again.
Seems to be something about Shelley's.
Hello?
Al? Oh, Al, you still with us? No, looks like we've lost Al. Ralph? Oh, you're back. Al, one of the questions I was asking you before you dropped is, in your term in Congress, you had interaction with the military and how, and you had some insight into how Washington was dealing with the North Koreans. Do you see a big difference between what's happening now and the information we're getting from Pyongyang versus when you were in Congress? And what are your thoughts on what's happening now versus when you were in Congress, and how should we deal with the North Koreans?
Well, when I was in Congress, foreign policy was not my strong point. And I often have to fight off the same feelings that I think the guy in the street does. Why don't we just blow the shit out of North Korea and be done with it? That is terrible policy, but it is a tempting way to react. And I am hoping that that not many members of Congress decide that that's the smart thing to do.
How, just in general, from a congressional standpoint, is how much say or how much pressure is coming from the Hill to have the White House act decisively? And in, is the new majority, is Speaker-elect Boehner and the Republican majority, even in concert with the Democratic minority, are they putting pressure on the White House to at least retaliate in a in an equal level?
I, first of all, I think it's too early to tell whether the minority and the majority are even talking to each other, you know, in the sense of being able to develop a relatively sophisticated thing such as you're suggesting. And then the second thing I think they have to do is they have to say what kind of retaliation. You know, somebody could propose the A-bomb. Everybody would go boo at that. Somebody would say, well, we should, you know, drop a little hand grenade. Everybody was going to say boo to that. Where between those two do you retaliate in a way that will not destabilize everything?
I agree with that. And I think you're going to have other parties in the picture, like China, like Mongolia, who the North Koreans have a relationship with, who they have tended to listen to in the past. I mean, they don't listen to the U.S. To them, we're still in a state of war. So all we can do is flex our military muscle. Other countries like China and Mongolia can move more along a diplomatic approach since they have had cultural and trade relations with North Korea for many, many years.
Well, let's give out our call-in number. For those of you who might be listening out in radio land, you can call in. The number to call in is 619-638-8477. Again, that's 619-638-8477, and that'll put you right into our switchboard, and we'll get you on the air with Ralph Winnie and Congressman Al Swift and myself.
You might just mention that do a one first, because I sat out three times without pushing one, so there may be somebody equally stupid as I am out
there. Oh, those are sage words of advice, Al. Well, seeing as how smoking is forbidden in my house, I hope you have a cigar in front of you, sir.
I have got a cigar going away. It's a nice Temple Hall, and I'm drinking soda water for the time being, but that will change.
Ralph, let's get back to Korea here real quick. One of the items that everybody's been talking about, not only in the media but inside the Beltway, is how effective, if at all, is Russia going to be in this, and do we in fact have to reach out to Russia to try and deal with the North Korean issue?
Well, I think eventually Russia could play a key role. The Russians are desperately seeking recognition and respect from the West as a major global economic and political superpower, and one of the ways they could achieve that is by being asked to act as an intermediary, to make overtures to North Korea, to work with them, and to basically keep the situation stable.
Okay.
What Russia will want in return is another matter to consider.
Okay. Well, we're coming up on the quarter past the hour. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, Al, we are going to talk about Al Swift's Golden Rules of Politics. And you sent that to me the other day. I think it's an absolute wonderful read. If this should be embossed in bronze and sent to everybody on the Hill, I think it's great, great reading for everybody. So stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Philly's Backroom by way of Florida, Hawaii, and Alice in Philly's Backroom. Stay tuned with us, folks. Show where I am broadcasting live from Melbourne, Florida. With me, as he is always, every Tuesday from 4 to 6, Congressman Al Swift. He's actually in Shelley's back room and the only one who's live there. Al, thanks for joining us again. And there we go. Al, thanks for joining us again.
Right.
And also with us is Dr. Ralph Winnie from the Eurasia Center, Vice President and General Pundit on all things Asian Pacific. Ralph, thanks again for joining us.
Glad to be with everybody.
Now, Al, you had said during the break that you had a question for Ralph that you thought we needed to address, and it does. Al, go ahead.
Yeah, and Ralph's the guy that has the answer to this. I think naturally the United States always looks at these things from the standpoint of the United States. How it affects us, how it screws us up, what problems it poses for us. But doesn't China have a whole bunch riding on this? The last thing I would think they would need right now as they're doing their economic expansion and what have you is to have a great deal of unrest in their area of the world.
Absolutely. One of the things they're very concerned about is a flood of Korean refugees from the north trying to get into China. North Koreans have put China in a very uncomfortable position, saying they're going to do something and then turning around and stabbing the Chinese in the back. So it's made the Chinese very uncomfortable with North Korean leadership, who at one time they had a very close relationship with as members of basically the same communist ideology. What has happened is China has moved towards a more free market capitalist system under the umbrella of the communist banner, whereas North Korea still maintains a very Stalinist system and is unwilling to embrace any aspects of free market capitalism into their economy. And that has caused them to be very resentful of the Chinese, who they feel have, in effect, betrayed the cause and moved towards more Western-style economic system. And the Chinese use North Koreans as very very unwilling to move forward in this global economy and creating a very dangerous situation.
Go ahead, Al.
So the North Koreans are posing problems for a lot of different countries. The problems they're posing are slightly different from country to country, but they're not making any friends in that part of the world.
Right. The North Koreans are really hurting their relationship with the Chinese by engaging in this type of behavior. That's why I think you're going to see China take a more active role in trying to put the North Koreans in their place. They're going to be more supportive of sanctions and more.
Japan can't be very happy about this either.
No. But, you know, the Chinese and the North Koreans have traditionally despised the Japanese because of what the Japanese Imperial Army did to millions of Chinese and Koreans during their occupation in World War II.
And, Ralph, we've got a couple of callers on the line, starting with the 808 area code. Caller, you're on the air with Ralph Winnie, Al Swift, and J.T. Russell.
Hi, this is May von der Lingen, and I wanted to know this recent problem on the Korean border. Do you think this is going to involve the U.S. at all?
Ralph?
Yes, it could. As the situation continues to spiral out of control, it certainly could involve the U.S. Being in Hawaii, we are very vulnerable to an attack. North Koreans have launched missiles into the Pacific, several that could conceivably reach Hawaii, namely Pearl Harbor. We have been attacked in the past, as everybody knows, back on December 7th, which caused U.S.'s entry into World War II. So North Korea is definitely a threat for the U.S., the U.S. is going to have to get, as I said, get very tough with the North Koreans. They're also going to have to involve China and Mongolia, who have had both a diplomatic, political, cultural, economic relationship with North Korea as key allies in making sure that North Korea stops their aggressive behavior. And the other issue that was raised was, do we involve Russia? Well, okay. Russia is it could also factor in as well because they have traditionally provided aid regime. What Russia will want in return will be another matter.
Caller, thank you very much for your call. Please, we hope you'll continue to listen to us. Thank you very much. We've got another call here. Caller from the 202 area code. You're on the air with Ralph Winnie, Congressman Al Swift, and JT.
Hi, thank you. My name is J.D. I'm from the D.C. area, and I have a question because so far our discussion has been focused on the Asian countries. What do you make of, if North Korea doesn't have relationships with China, they're losing friends, of them developing friendships with Middle Eastern countries? You know, they're suggesting that Pakistan provided them with much of the equipment to make their new nuclear weapons or reactors, whatever you want to say. They're also talking about collaboration with Iran. We know that Venezuela has been an actor in a lot of these things. To what extent do we think North Korea is working with people outside of Asia? And what implications does that have for U.S. policy?
Ralph?
Well, there's no question that North Korea has a very close relationship with Syria and Venezuela and Iran.
We're pretty much talking about the axis of evil at this point, as President Bush said in the State of the Union.
Absolutely. And it's incumbent on the world community to get aggressive and get very tough. The problem is people have a need for resources, and they have been unwilling or unable to have the guts to clamp down on North Korea and to get tough with them. I think now people are starting to realize that the North Korean regime is becoming very unstable. And if it continues to go unchecked, you could have something literally exploding out of Asia. that could have horrible consequences for the rest of the world.
Caller, thanks a lot for checking in with us. We hope you'll stay tuned and listen to us often. Thank you very much. Al, I gotta ask you a question in all of this is we've heard a lot of debate in the actions that we've taken in Afghanistan, the actions that we've taken in Iraq. If by some chance, and God forbid, the Korean Peninsula escalates, do you think that Congress is going to want to have more of a say of the use of military options as opposed to the simple police actions that we used in Iraq or Afghanistan, arguably?
I think it almost has to. We've got two wars on our hands and a budget deficit that is just killing us. Three wars and the expenses attached thereto would almost break the bank. So I think there will be those who will be verbose and will want to rattle the missiles and all the rest, but we need to be very, very careful to use every diplomatic means we possibly can, because I think there's some question, and I think the question will be raised in Congress as to whether we can fight three wars at one time.
And Al, I want to ask you this question. Actually, I'm going to pose this question to both of you. Obviously, Secretary of State Clinton is going to be an integral part in how we view and deal and respond to the situation on the Korean Peninsula today. I want to start off with you, Al. How effective do you think Secretary Clinton is going to be in dealing with the Koreans? And I hate to get chauvinistic. Can she do it, A, as the Secretary of State for the United States? B, can she do it as a female in a largely male-dominated society such as North Korea?
The second one, she has been doing quite well, I think, in my personal view, in dealing with a variety of societies that are very male-dominated, the whole Mideast, for example. So I don't know, but I would I tend to bet with her on that. She has been, I think, extremely capable, and this, of course, is going to really pressure her enormously. But I think it's way too early to suggest that she might not be up to the job.
Okay. Ralph, I pose that same question to you.
Yeah, I think so far she's been very effective. She reminds me of Golda Meir. She has the same personality, very tough, and she can deal with in a very male-dominated hierarchy, such as in North Korea. I think the key will be for her to involve other countries like the Chinese, like the Mongolians, maybe even reach out to Russia so that there is a united front against North Korea. The North Koreans have been very successful in playing both sides against the other and in creating divisions. Go ahead, Al.
And I think while the vice president has been very, very circumspect, he also has a very solid foreign policy background from his service on the Foreign Affairs Committee in key positions in the Senate. So that's another advantage another tool that the administration can apply to this problem.
But we would have very strong relations with many of these world leaders can exercise some political capital and bringing together a united front against North Korea.
And we've got another call from the 202. Caller from the 202, you're on with Congressman Al Swift, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and Justin. Caller from the 202. Not there. Okay. Ralph, you're still here?
Yes, I'm here.
We're going to take a break here. We're at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, Al, can stay with us for your normal segments. I'd like to keep you on, and I'd like to talk about Swift's rules of politics. I know Korea's going to be foremost on our mind, but I definitely got to get to this. This goes to the heart of what the First Congress Society and our show is all about. So, Ralph, Al, stay with us. Listeners, stay with us. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Thank you.
From Shelley's back room. Al, thanks for staying with us. And also with us is Ralph Winney, Dr. Ralph Winney, Vice President of the Eurasia Center. Ralph, thank you very much for joining us again. And Al, you there with us? Al?
Hello, hello.
There we are. There we go. We lost everybody for a second. I'm figuring out the switchboard with all these callers. Al, first of all, I wanted to say thanks for staying with us. And in this segment, I wanted to talk to you about something that you sent me over the weekend, which I've been involved in this game not nearly as long as you have. I don't nearly have the sage wisdom that you do about politics and political insight, but Swift's Laws of Politics is absolutely something that I think every freshman incoming to the Hill should get a bronze plaque of and put in their office right next to their desk. Al, how did you come up with this?
Well, it's not all at one time. I just began to notice some ironies in the process back here, and I started to formulate them just for the fun of it as Swift's laws. They're not Swift laws. In fact, maybe we want to make them our laws and put them on our website. But they tell truths about politics in ways that are a little flip, a little glib, but there's some real substance to them. I would like to begin with what is my 10th law, which is always apply Taylor's first law. Now, Herbert C. Taylor, was a professor of anthropology at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington, and a very bright man. And he was involved in politics. academic politics. I've always said no mere professional politician can survive either in condo politics or in academic politics. And in, from his experience, he developed Taylor's first law, which is do not ascribe to conspiracy that for which stupidity will suffice for an answer.
That is a huge, huge, almost a piece of insight. Do you find that lots of members of Congress and lots of members of the political infrastructure in Washington, this is something they should use as gospel?
Yeah, I think that you're almost always right that whatever it is, it's not conspiracy. First of all, a real conspiracy is usually incredibly difficult to pull off. You've got to be sure that the little ball drops in exactly the right hole and rolls down the right pipe and turns off the right switch that lights the candle, that burns the string, that does, you know, that's it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And it just rarely happens. What you've got, it doesn't mean that you haven't got people that are after you. It just means that it's probably a planned attack, not a conspiracy. Let me give you an example. Hillary Clinton was famed for talking about the vast conservative conspiracy, right-wing conspiracy. Well, there wasn't any question during that time that the right wing was planning all kinds of ways to try and embarrass the Clinton administration and to upset its plans and interfere. But that wasn't a conspiracy. That was a planned attack. And as a result, I think, and she said, there is a coordinated effort on the part of the right wing to attack the Clinton administration. She would never have been made fun of. It was the great right-wing conspiracy, the word that made her seem naive and that made Jay Leno and the nighttime guys have a ball.
Let me ask you this question then. I mean, we hear the conspiracy theories of the grassy knoll in The Unfortunate, which unfortunately we're in the week of the 50th anniversary of the death of President Kennedy, but we hear about the grassy knoll and the conspiracy of the magic bullet. We hear about the conspiracy theorists who are out there claiming that the U.S. government was directly involved and wanted to see 9/11 happen. Does this suffice, not to name call, but does this suffice as an answer, that answer equaling stupidity?
I think briefly, I think you can replace the word conspiracy in Taylor's first law with a number of other words. It's not always stupidity, but it is rarely a conspiracy. It's just somebody trying to get something done that you don't want done, and it's convenient to think that they're somehow conspiring against you when they're not.
Well, you obviously knew Dr. Taylor well. This is not something that he formulated over years. Was there a particular experience, or was this a general observation that he noticed about the political infrastructure?
I think it is something he developed over years of watching faculties do battle. The thing about college professors is that they are about the only people in the world whose basic purpose is to find truth. And a great many of them think they've found it. And as a result, they are slow to compromise. They are quick to insist that they're right. And they formulate often conspiracy theories to explain their position. So I think it developed by watching campus politics for 20 years.
Wow. Al, let's go into Swift's laws now, because I think that just as Dr. Taylor's law is great overarching gospel unto itself, These are the Ten Commandments of politics, in my view. Your first law.
The first law is simply this, that the first thing you lose when you win public office is your reputation.
This is obviously something you gathered from experience.
From experience. I remember specifically when I was on a little group of 15 people who had 3 months to rewrite the Bellingham City Charter. And there was a very lovely matron lady. She was just a citizen, a housewife, and a secretary in her job. And we had hearings, and a little man came and he said, "I want you to know that if you do anything, to violate the First Amendment, you will have me to answer to." And she said, first of all, what on earth could we do to the First Amendment, first of all? But she said, why in the world would you think we would do something like that? She was stunned to think that just yesterday she was a housewife, now she's an elected official, and they're suspecting her of trying to revise the Constitution. So what happened is she got elected, and she lost her reputation.
What, Al? Just over the course of time in your political career, how did you put these in this exact order?
I think as they came to mind. There's nothing magic about the order, except in a couple of instances. There are two that are very similar that I put together. But it's just that you can't expect to be in politics and not be considered a politician. And once you're considered a politician, people think ill of you. It's just the nature of the beast. And we can go back and quote people going back centuries, but Mark Twain is a good example of someone who could say the most awful things about politics. it's part of our culture.
Al, tell me about the second law.
Well, the second law is, this is really something that you should keep in mind for later on in your career. Any public official who expects to receive either gratitude or immortality will be sadly disappointed. No one is going to say thank you. The only times I ever got thank yous was when I did something easy. You know, I voted to condemn Adolf Hitler again. We used to do that annually for reasons I never understood, but we did. And people would say, there you go, you had the guts to vote against Hitler. Well, of course, it took absolutely no guts to vote against Hitler whatsoever. On the other hand, on the tough votes, the ones that were serious policy issues. And people, some people agreed with them, some people disagreed with them. Those who disagreed would sure let you know. Those who agreed with you thought, well, you're just doing what you're supposed to do. So you didn't get a lot of compliments for anything that really took any guts to do. I'm talking about compliments on your courage. You never got compliments on your courage for doing a controversial thing.
Al, just as this is the second law of politics under Al Swift's laws, could this be turned around and used as a deadly sin for those who do expect it?
Could you repeat that?
I said,
could it be turned around?
Yeah, those, you know, we sit here and we look at the second law. Any public official who expects to receive either gratitude or immortality will be sadly disappointed. You and I and Ralph all know members and former members who do expect gratitude and immortality in their service in Congress. Is that instead of it being the second law of Swift's laws, is that in fact, if you turn it around and those who expect it, does that become a deadly sin?
Well, I think if they expect it, they end up being disappointed. They end up sometimes being very bitter. They end up thinking that all votes are easy. and that, again, will disappoint them. The immortality is something most of them don't live long enough to know whether they received it or not. And so you have Abraham Lincoln, and you have George Washington, and a few others. But my state had two of the most senior senators in the government. Senator Warren Magnuson, who was chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and Senator Scoot Jackson, who was very, very influential in armed services and so forth. Both were first and fourth in seniority in the Senate. They were incredible powers in the Senate. And if you go home to my home state today and ask anybody under 40 if they have ever heard of Scoot Jackson or Warren Magnuson, they will look blankly at you and say no. In other words, the two most successful politicians in Washington State's history have already been pretty much forgotten.
Well, let's talk about the third law, Al, and I'll read this one. Agreeing on the problem is easy. The trouble begins when you propose a solution. That almost seems like the basis of civil discourse or civil debate.
Well, it's one of the reasons that when anybody talks about the deficit, they say that they're going to cut it by cutting waste, fraud, and abuse, because there's nobody who's for waste, fraud, and abuse. Any other solution they propose is going to tee a whole bunch of people off, and we're about to go into a period where we are going to learn exactly how true that is. The fourth law, which is very similar and just a little different, but it's just when people stop bitching about the problem, they will start bitching about the solution. It's essentially the same thing. I wondered when the president was running for change and never defined change, if he wasn't going to run into problems when his sense of what needed to be changed became clear, because there were clearly going to be people who didn't agree that that was the change they wanted.
Well, this brings us into the fourth law. When people stop bitching about the problem, they will start bitching about the solution.
That's the same as the first one. It's just, I like it because it has the word bitching in it.
You're such a simple man, Al. Such a simple man. Al, you know, it's funny because, you know, we look at Governor Chris Christie up in New Jersey, and for those who have listened to our shows in and out of the dropouts, they'll know that I'm a huge fan of Governor Christie. But we saw that with Chris Christie when, you know, in his campaign, he was very elusive. How are you going to fix this? Well, I'm just going to. And then when he became governor, he made some very, very critical decisions. He proposed solutions, and then people started bitching about the solutions, and he just went forward. Are we going to see – does the Obama administration adhere to either the third or the fourth law of Swift's Laws of Politics? Have you seen that recently in any of their in any of their positions or policies?
Well, they should by now have understood it if they didn't earlier. Because they've been catching hell. There was absolutely no question that people wanted reform of health care. A lot of people didn't want this reform of health care, or for that matter, any of the other proposals. There was a clear majority against single payer. There was anything proposed had opponents to it. So you can't make a positive, can't propose a positive solution to any problem and expect to get unanimous support for it. There will you'll be lucky if you don't have, at least initially, virtually a majority opposed to you. Then you got to go out and sell it.
All right. Well, Al, we're coming up on the break here. Al, if you can stay with us for the next segment, we'd like to go through this again. Ralph, if you can stay with us also from the Aloha State out there in Hawaii. God, I'm jealous. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room, and we will be right back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. And we're back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's back room. At least Congressman Al is in Shelley's back room enjoying a cigar and a drink. I am J.T. Russell, your host, and I am broadcasting live from Florida's Space Coast, which that's going to bring up a whole nother show, the whole space program issue, but that's down the road. Also joining us is Dr. Ralph Winnie from the Eurasia Center. And Al, before we go to going back to the laws, we've got a caller on the line. And caller from the 202 area code, you're on Backroom Politics.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you, Dr. Ralph and Congressman Swift. I actually have a question all of you can share your thoughts on. I'm always fascinated about this whole idea that politicians winning elections is changing. We have a representation of it.
Caller, you're fading on us.
Yeah, caller, can you speak up? I can't hear.
No, he dropped off. He dropped off.
Talk louder.
Yeah. He dropped off.
Can you hear him?
No, he dropped off.
I can hear somebody.
No, that's me.
Well, he's calling again.
Yeah.
Yeah, hopefully he'll call in again. So, Al, let's go back and caller from the 202 area code. Please feel free to call in again. We just need you to get a better signal on your cell phone. Al, let's go back to, one of the things that we look at is your seventh law.
Seventh law.
Nothing is easier than to criticize somebody else's compromise.
Yeah, there is literally nothing easier than being able to criticize somebody else's compromise, because the person who made the compromise had to draw the lines. They had to give up something. They had to decide what they were going to get in response for it. And no matter how hard or even how wise the compromise is, virtually everybody else in the world can say they would have done it differently. So that when you stick your neck out to form a compromise, you can expect to be roundly criticized by friends and foes. It's not the way they would have done it.
Did you find that in a lot of the compromises? I mean, let's be real about this. Al, you were known as being a practical congressman. You weren't afraid to cross the aisle and make the deals or make concessions or compromise in many instances. Did you find that those close to you were some of your biggest critics?
In some instances, yes. A very good friend of mine, who turned out to be a very good friend of mine, Dick Ottinger of New York, was the single strongest opponent against the first bill I ever introduced in the Energy and Commerce Committee, and passed. So that, you got to expect that. That was a liberal Democrat fighting with a liberal Democrat about something that that we disagreed on. So that's true. But what I found
Al,
is
I
if you're going to try.
For you.
Go ahead, Ralph.
Many people say, well, I'll compromise, but I'm not going to compromise on my principles. How do you respond to that?
My response is you should not compromise your principles, but you should be very, very careful of how many things you move up to the status of principle. I mean, very often people will call a principle, in fact, something that is an opinion, a preference for a policy. It's not a principle. A principle is will you lie? Will you kill? Will you commit perjury or even do damage to your country? And the answer is you don't do those things. But if you take, for example, let's take the health care bill. If you say that is a matter of principle, you basically take a solution you can work with off the table, and you're left with nothing. So the principles are more important, more fundamental kinds of things than are policies. policies can be compromised. Principles should not be.
Well, Al, we're, you know, when we look at the rules of law, we look at the eighth rule of Swiss politics, political law, and that is every reform carries with it the seeds of the abuse that will require the next reform. Reading that almost sounds jaded. It almost sounds cynical of our political process. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I think that's exactly how it sounds, and I think I kind of mischievously wanted it to sound that way. But what I mean by that is that you can't expect any reform to last forever. You will make a reform and it'll work for, you know, quite a while. And then things change around it, and pretty soon you're going to need another reform. In short, never believe that you are coming up with the final reform, the reform that will make perfection and will last forever. It's not possible.
What about the ninth law? If you were to resurrect the 100th finest minds that ever lived in the history of mankind and form them into a committee, it would take about half an hour for them to do something stupid. That is a huge, 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 I don't even know how to even describe that. That's mind-blowing to me.
Well, and it usually takes me about 20 minutes to explain it. I use this with college students, college classes often. The point I'm trying to make is that there is a whole dynamic that goes on in making group decisions. And if those 100 wise men came to a 51-49 vote, it doesn't mean that the 51 all agree. One of those might have just barely voted for it because he thought it was a little bit better than the alternative, whereas somebody else might have thought that it was just the most fabulous idea in the world. Both voted aye, but it leaves the impression of something that's not there. Basically, what you have to keep in mind is that in a democracy, when you finally get around to taking a vote, when you take all of these ideas and all of the debate and all of the arguments for and against various proposals and you vote, what you have is arithmetic. You count the votes. And that's it. So when we say, well, the city council really was stupid this week, the state legislature was idiotic, the Congress did something really dumb today, you're not stating something accurate. You're saying that that some people did some things that you think were stupid or wrong or what have you. What you really need to do is, rather than condemning everyone, and we've heard many times, I say, throw all the bums out, you know, and get a whole new gang. That's based on the idea that they're all the same, and they're not. You really would have to go and look up your representatives, a vote on an issue, and see whether he was one who voted against your position, or if he wasn't, or she wasn't.
Al, is this something, I mean, I read, is this coincidence that I see 100 finest minds and a half hour for them to do something stupid? Am I reading too much in this by thinking this might be directed at the Senate? Again, I could be wrong, Al, but
I have to remind you that I said the 100 finest minds.
Oh, there is that little disclaimer. There is that. And remember, for those of you out there that might be listening in Radio Land, the views and expressions viewed by Congressman Al Swift do not necessarily be the views of the First Congress Society, J.T. Russell, or Dr. Ralph Winnie.
Or anybody else, for that matter.
Yeah, that's right. There's, in other words, they're strictly Al Swift's views.
And the 100 minds had nothing whatever to do with the Senate. at all. I don't mind taking a whack at the Senate, but this isn't one of them. It's
right.
Just that you need to understand that 100 people are going to have probably 100 different reasons why they voted the way they did.
Right.
And when you add it all up, it's arithmetic.
Now, the question for you is this. Let's say the health care bill. All of your constituents are telling you, no, this is a bad bill. We don't want you to vote for it. But you know in your heart, you know that it's something that is in their best interest. How do you vote? Do you vote for what your constituents want, or do you vote according to your own conscience because you know that once this bill is passed, that's going to be wonderful things for your constituents. They just don't know it yet.
I think it depends on how important the vote is. There's no point in going down in flames over something that is really not terribly important. But when it's something that I once was on the losing side of a 2-0 vote in the House, so I've got a person in the gallery here saying, "What?" It's too long a story to tell, but I think there are times when you need to say, "This is one I am willing to go home and defend." I also wish I had the card that I keep with me usually to quote Edmund Burke on this point. But while he said it much more beautifully than I did, he basically said that an elected official who sacrifices his opinion for that of his constituents denies them his... It denies them his full effort as much as if he reduced the amount of labor he put into it. In short, there's got to be a place to vote, again, on principle.
Well, Al, if we can, let's take a break here. We're up against the break right now. We're going to take a 2-minute break. And when we come back, we're going to get to the mother of all of Al Swift's laws. That is the 10th law of Al Swift's politics. And then we've got a couple of other topics we want to talk about, particularly the Duke Cunningham issue and Ed Towns taking head of the Oversight Committee. So Ed Towns is not with us, but Congressman Al Swift is. Dr. Ralph Winnie, I am J.T. Russell. We'll be back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's back room, well, at least through Florida and Hawaii, out there. And we're back. We're here live in Florida, at least I am. This is Backroom Politics. It's 8 past the hour of 5 o'clock here on the East Coast, 8 past the hour of 3 o'clock out there out west. And joining me, as always, every Tuesday is Congressman Al Swift. Al, thanks for joining me for the second hour.
Always.
And joining us from America's 50th state and just basic Howley on the scene, Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, welcome from Hawaii.
Glad to be with everybody.
Oh, thanks. If you
join Why aren't you out in the surf? Why aren't you out in the surf? I mean, instead of sitting here on a telephone, this is ridiculous. I have nothing else to do but sit here.
Al, haven't you seen him walk into Shelley's before? That kind of coordination. Do you really want him on a surfboard? That's proof positive right there, kids.
Just we get in a wrestling match, then we'll see who wins.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just waiting for them to declare you the fourth King Kamehameha.
Well, and as far as the wrestling match is concerned, I've been known to lose a wrestling match to a two-year-old, so that's something to brag about.
Okay, well, that being the case, since we're dealing with mental wrestling matches here today, for those of you who are just joining us for the second hour, we were talking in our last segment with Al Swift, and Al has written what he calls the laws of politics, or the Swift's laws of politics, and there are 10, and I still contend that these should be looked at as the 10 political commandments of every new freshman coming in. Democratic, Republican, does not matter. These should be just engraved in bronze or brass, and they should be handed to every member that comes in fresh, and it should be hanging on the wall by their desk, and they should look at these every day. These are political genius here, Al. And I got to tell you, they're amazing. I mean, it's simplistic, but they're incredibly, incredibly insightful. Let's go back. We're going to jump up to one that you wanted to talk about earlier, and that's the sixth law. And what is that one, Al?
The sixth law is very simple. It says the best way to avoid being blamed for anything is to do nothing. And
wow.
I came up with that one as I was a freshman. I got on the elevator, and there was a longtime senior Democrat from the South. This was before the Republicans took over the South, and he was talking to other freshmen. He was kind of instructing them. And he says, now I'm here to tell you, he says, what you've got to do now is you've got to vote for every appropriation. You've got to vote against every tax increase. And you need to then develop the ability to denounce vigorously and long and loud all the vagaries of the status quo.
Al, I got to ask you a question. Obviously seen the Obama administration get criticized for doing nothing. One of the things that comes to mind as I read the sixth law is, are they in fact taking blame for doing nothing? Or in fact, are they doing something and they're taking blame because they just can't communicate that they're doing something?
I think it's the latter. I think they have done quite a bit. You can argue whether it's good or bad. That's a matter of opinion. But they have done quite a bit, and they have not been able to figure out how to explain it. For example, I think that TARP, first of all, it was started under George Bush. He, in his recent statements, said that he would do it again, that it was essential. He knew it was not conservative, but he said we had the world's economy at stake and we had to do something. Obama picked that up, made some few changes here and there, and then proceeded to expand it, and I think truly did prevent a world financial breakdown. But why he couldn't explain that the way I just did is beyond me.
Is it something that, I mean, is this a law of politics that that may have applied to George Bush? I mean, George Bush was accused of doing nothing, being disconnected. When in fact, now that we're seeing, is this a law that was applied to George Bush that we're now seeing being rescinded? Or is this something that is just, you know, in the eyes of the beholder, in some instances, in the eyes of the media?
It's something that the public forgot. I remember when Nelson Rockefeller won the California primary in running for president, and everyone was wondering what his divorce and then marrying the new wife, what was her name, I can't remember. It was a big test, and I remember one of the commentators said, well, it didn't seem to bother him at all. I think what we have here is less a matter of public morality, it's a matter of public memory. I think George Bush has unfairly been forgotten for what he did. I happen to think that TARP was a good idea. And I think that if you took two administrations that had a hard time with their PR, it's Bush and Obama. Ronald Reagan would have handled it totally differently and been a hero.
Right.
Well, Obama's made a big mistake in constantly criticizing George Bush. It's really starting to irritate and anger people because they want to know what Obama is going to do to fix this economy, not blame the previous president. I don't remember Bush criticizing Clinton or even Clinton criticizing Bush Sr.
Well, I don't think I agree with that, but I also don't think it's worth spending a lot of time arguing out.
Right. That's a topic for another show down the road, I think. Now we come to the 10th law. Al,
yes.
What is the 10th law of Swift's Rules of Politics?
And I hadn't thought of it, but you may be right in saying this is the best one. It says every side of an issue has idiots defending it. That doesn't make it wrong.
Can we make that the mantra of the First Congress Society? Because that's a great mantra.
It's a great mantra. I can sit around and go to it. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the thing about it is when I read this, you know, I look at the Tea Party, and then I also look at you know, some of the far left organizations like MoveOn.org. Not saying that the Tea Party or MoveOn.org are idiots, but you look at every side of their key cornerstone issues, and there are idiots defending it. Doesn't mean that their positions are wrong. It just means that in some instances they could be idiots.
Well, let me give you an example. The congressman from I think Nebraska, one termer, who took the floor to explain where in fact the government could cut spending. He said abolish the Weather Bureau. Because he said we can get all that information on television. the idea of cutting spending isn't idiotic. That idea was idiotic.
Wow, that is absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Al, you know, I gotta take a look here real quick. We're coming up against the break once again. We're coming up at the quarter of the hour. Stay with us again, please.
Yeah, I will, and I'm going to go see if I can find Doc and see if he's got a phone, and I'll be right back.
No, there's no telling. Ralph, you'll be able to stay with us from Hawaii, I hope.
Ralph? Yes.
You'll be able to stay with us, I hope.
Yes, definitely.
Great, great.
Before I talk to Chuck, what are we going to be talking about next?
Well, Al, right now we're going to be going to the break right now, so stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room by way of Florida and Hawaii and other points in between. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Washington, D.C. Or at least one of us is. Al, you're broadcasting live from Shelley's Back Room, aren't you?
I am indeed.
Very good. And I am broadcasting live from the beautiful sunshine and citrus encrusted command center here in Melbourne, Florida, where the sunset
the
is
citrus encrusted command
yes.
center. Is that
yes.
what you said?
Yes.
I love it.
The sunset here is absolutely gorgeous. You could not have asked for a better day. The reason why I'm saying this is I got to rub this into Al. But the one who could really rub it into Al the most is Dr. Ralph Winnie, our Howley in charge in Honolulu. Ralph, thanks for joining us from Hawaii.
Glad to be here. Aloha to everyone.
Yeah, mahalo, brother. Mahalo.
Let me tell you a joke you can tell while you're out there, Ralph. A guy gets off a plane in Honolulu, and he walks up to somebody, the first person he sees, and he said, I've really always wondered how you properly pronounce this state. Is it Hawaii or Hawaii? And the guy said, Hawaii. And he said, thank you very much. And the guy said, you're welcome.
I'll be sure to share that.
Yeah. You know what? I'm sure the Islanders will love you for that one. That is that's a great Howley joke.
Courtesy of Al Smith.
And all my Jewish friends will love it too.
Yeah, that's right. Oh my God! Oh, that is fantastic. First of all, I gotta thank Al. Al, you've been absolutely fantastic in providing us with the Swift rules of politics, the Swift laws, which is not to be confused with Swift boats. That's a whole nother political issue. But these are literally something that not only the First Congress Society that we're a part of should embrace, but you know, it just talks about the reality. It kind of puts politics in simple terms. It just kind of brings perspective to it. Was that the intent? Is that what you're looking at? And do you see a future for these laws being implemented in the halls of Congress?
No, I don't expect them to be. Well, they are implemented every day, as a matter of fact. I think that one of the responsibilities that elected officials have is to try and explain government to their constituents. I think there is far too little of that. I remember interviewing a congressman, and I said, tell me about lobbyists. He said, oh, they're awful. You know, I don't want anybody telling me what to do, providing, one, the wrong answer, and two, in no way informing his audience, but rather reinforcing a prejudice they might have. And so these were designed, I hope, to bring out occasionally and use to help explain how government really works, what some of its warts are, and help them understand why it works the way it does.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up lobbying, because also included with the Book of Political Commandments that you've given us is Tom Wheeler's Law of Lobbying. Al, who's Tom Wheeler?
Tom Wheeler has been around this town for a long, long time. He's not lobbying now, but when I first met him, he was president of the National Cable Television Association. A great leader of that group, incidentally, and one against whom I had some problems. I was had a broadcast background, and broadcasting and cable in those days were each other's throats a good deal of the time. But he's a brilliant guy, and he made the observation once, and this pleased me because he told it to me one day when I was having unshirted hell from some of the public interest groups who demand perfection in everything. And he pointed out this difference, that a regular lobbyist, you know, needs to succeed because that's the way he keeps the money coming in.
Yeah.
The public interest lobbyist needs to lose because that's how they keep the money coming in.
Well, Al, is that something that you see? That's something that you see in a lot of the. Is that just as true now as it was back when you were in the halls of Congress? And as a current lobbyist, do you feel that's true even today?
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, it is just a truism. Look at it this way: if you hire me as a lobbyist to do something perfectly legitimate, you need to have your industry understood better on the Hill, because let's say a tax law is going to treat you differently than everybody else because of a unique aspect of your business. And so you hire me, and I go up there and fiddle around, and I work for 2 years, and you pay me a sizable amount of money, and I get nothing done. You are likely to fire me and hire a lobbyist who can get something done. On the other hand, if a good government lobbyist achieves their end, they're out of a job.
Yeah.
And so it has always seemed to me, for example, if there's one group on public on campaign finance reform who insisted always that they must have their entire package adopted. They couldn't have a piece of it. They couldn't have sections of it. They had to have the whole thing. Well, that's the surest way to get nothing done. And I remember them playing that one for 20 years. They got paid every year for getting nothing done.
Well,
Al, do you think Obama has made a mistake by not having a lot of lobbyists in his administration who can help to shape and guide the administration?
Yes, I think the only thing he said when he became president that made me cringe was his pledge not to have any lobbyists. That's like saying, I don't want anybody to be helping me who knows anything about this town. A lobbyist who works for XYZ company with expertise, let's say, in the tax law, can move to the administration or to a committee and take all of that knowledge with them and not be there as a an employee and employ for their former employer. The loyalty switches to the person who is currently paying you. And I think that is true in 99% of the cases. So what you do by saying we won't allow any lobbyists in is it means, or for that matter, we won't let members of the administration or Congress go out to lobby, is that you're depriving the entire system of knowledge about how the whole place works.
Right. Well, Al, you know, again, thank you very much for bringing this to us. I think it's a great, great piece of insight. It is a fantastic view. It's a simplistic view of everything that's going on. And it's definitely laws that we should all definitely adhere to, not only in politics, but in public service and public life. Thank you again, Al. You'll be seeing these. We'll probably be posting these on the First Congress blog. We'll definitely post these on the Blog Talk Radio show site for Backroom Politics. Again, Al, thanks a lot for that. I want to go back to a topic that we brought up in the beginning of the show that looks like it's just now escalating again. We're getting word that South Korea leaders are calling for enormous retaliation on the Korean Peninsula. The Korean government has called for retaliations, and this is courtesy of CNN, and that the South Korean government said the incident is, quote, an invasion of South Korean territory, unquote. Al, you've been around the Beltway long enough, and you've been around to see major and minor conflicts involving the United States and involving some of our allies. Al, does this seem like we're past the point of no return? Is this going to escalate beyond control?
Well, that's a look into the future question, and I don't know. And I think Ralph is much more qualified to run those traps and make those guesses. But it seems to me that if I were the Secretary of State, I'd be doing everything I could right now to calm them down. Because once they start throwing bombs at each other, it's going to be very hard to stop it.
Ralph, what do you think? Are we past the point of no return here, or can – as Al has suggested, can the Secretary of State and the UN kind of allow cooler minds to prevail?
Well, I think the six-party talks are going to be key. To engage Korea and keep them from acting rashly. They have done everything they can to provoke the South Koreans. And at this point, the South is just set up, and they're demanding that the North be held accountable. The key is going to be dealing with their nuclear weapons program. Can we get North Korea to allow more weapons inspectors in there? Can we get them engaging in six-party talks and to see how this military transition works with North Korea's son, forget his name now, but he's going to be taking over from Kim Jong-il.
Right.
What kind of transition? How is that going to affect the situation with the military in South Korea? Because that's the key. They're trying to make the sun more palatable to the North Korean military, and one of the ways they're doing it is by using nuclear muscle and seeing how far they can provoke the South Koreans.
Ralph, one question also that comes to mind is, can in the transfer of power, from what you know, because not many people know what's going on right now, is in your views, have you seen any indications that the succession of power from Kim Jong-il to his son, will his son be more aggressive? Will he be more apt to go to war on the peninsula, or could he be one of the cooler heads that we might find in the future?
Well, the key is for him to be able to get into power. I think if he gets into power, he'll be one of the more cooler heads. The problem is he has to show or boost his credentials with the North Korean military, and the way that you do that is to come out tough and fighting against the South. And this is what has created this situation now, where the North is trying to goad the South and engage them. They're not intending to move it into a full-scale armed conflict, but their actions certainly can escalate a situation that could lead to a major nuclear war if cooler heads don't prevail. But the key now is for the politicians on both the U.S., China, Mongolia, and even Russia to engage the North and get everyone talking, get everyone sitting down. But at the same time, don't acquiesce to the North. You've got to stand, as part of a united front, you've got to stand tough, and you've got to let the North know that there will be consequences if they continue to go to the South like they're doing right now. And I think China is going to definitely be on board with that because they are getting fed up with the North. North Koreans are creating such an unstable situation there that, for once, the Chinese now are going to put the foot down and the North is going to be forced to listen.
Okay. We're going to take another break. Ralph, stay with us. We're going to take another break right now and then we'll close out the show. We're going to talk about when we come back. We want to definitely talk about a new poll that came out according to Politico. It's a Quinnipiac poll that basically is talking that President Obama and Mitt Romney are in a head-to-head race if the election were to be held today. But we've still got another year we've got about another year, 2 years before we have to go deal with that. But stay with us. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom. At least Al is. I'm broadcasting live from the beautiful Sunshine State, the Space Coast in Melbourne, Florida. And we will be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned. Thank you.
down the chimney. Hello?
Are we? Yeah, hey, Al.
Hi. Are we still at it?
I think we're in the green room, right?
I think we're in limbo.
Yeah.
Okay, well, limbo it may be. I learned a lot listening to you tonight.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Said I learned a lot listening to you tonight.
Well, thank you. And so did I. This is a very good issue. Will generate a lot of.
Well, and it's just the perfect issue for you, and it happened at exactly the right time when we needed you to get in and fill up some time too.
Yeah, well, especially being in Hawaii.
And we're back. This is Justin Russell. We're back live from Shelly's back room, although down here in Florida. We're using the Coconut Telegraph right now, but also joining us is, as always, the Honorable Al Swift. Al, thanks for joining us from Shelly's.
You're welcome.
And also joining us is our Howlian residents, I don't even dare call him our King Kamehameha. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie, joining us from the great state of Hawaii. Ralph, mahalo.
Hey,
let's talk a little bit real quick about a couple of the issues. One I wanted to talk about is the latest Quinnipiac poll that was released yesterday, and we get this news courtesy of our friends over at Politico.com. Apparently there is a Quinnipiac poll that shows that President Obama is in a neck and neck race against Mitt Romney, and arguably Mitt Romney is the presumptive inside the beltway front runner for the Republican nomination in 2012. Al, I've got to ask your question first. Is Al, is this indicative of a anti-Obama sentiment, or is this indicative of just the Republicans capitalizing on a wave of anti-incumbent support?
Well, I think it's more likely the latter. I must tell you that I am very skeptical of very early polling because it's just so far out that it doesn't mean much. But if it means anything, I think it means that Romney is one up on the other Republican candidates. And you'd also have to say that it's not good news for Obama either, but neither is it dreadful. We're 2 years out, and so much can happen and will happen in that amount of time.
Ralph, you've been involved in polling before, I believe. What do you think? I mean, you know, right now we look at the polls coming out of Quinnipiac, coming out of Rasmussen, coming out of Marist. When we see those polls, traditionally the polls that I've always been involved in have included only landline numbers. Can this be an accurate representation, or are these just traditional old schoolers who refuse to get rid of their landline phones? Are these numbers in this poll indicative of just old people voting? There's no young influence in this?
Well, I think what it's showing is that the economy is on everyone's mind. And Romney has a solid record. If you look at how he came in after the Salt Lake chicken scandal and turned that whole thing around and made it, you look at how he ran Massachusetts, knows how to run a business. He's very effective, gets things up, compromised. And it's, you know, people recognize that. However, I do with Al, I think it's a little early. And the key for Obama is to turn the economy around. If he does that, I don't think that there's anyone that's going to beat him. But if the economy continues to go down the tube, you're going to see people looking towards Canada's economy that has had the success of creating jobs.
Now, in your experience in polling, and you said you were not a fan of polling to begin with, is there a certain responsibility for the pollsters to, I mean, are the pollsters just in it for the money, or is there a responsibility of the pollsters that they should really say, hey, it's too early for us to do this, this could unduly influence, or this could be just useless information that's out there for political fodder?
Well, most responsible pollsters, and I think most of them are, will tell you this is a shot in time. Tomorrow it could be different. And as long as they're saying that, I don't have any trouble with it. My skepticism is not of the pollsters. In fact, I tend to believe polls. But I think when they're taken is terribly important. And I mean it's way too early to be polling on those particular issues.
What purpose does it serve other than just saber rattling, Al?
Well, who took this poll again?
This is a Quinnipiac poll that was released yesterday.
And it wasn't taken for anybody in particular?
No, nope, it was just a general Quinnipiac poll that was released.
Yeah. And your question was?
Other than the obvious, what purpose does a poll like this coming out this early serve?
I don't think it serves any. It serves the pollsters. Somebody's paying them to do it. It gets the pollster's name out. It does very little of real substance. It probably doesn't do any harm either. You know, so let the boys play with their toys and just don't put a lot of confidence in it.
And we've got we've got a caller holding on the line, an unknown caller, so unidentified caller. You're on Backroom Politics with Congressman Al Swift, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and Justin Russell.
Yeah. Hi, how you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I think it's important to take a step back and look at the bigger picture of things, and that is that we have a two-party mafia in Washington. It doesn't matter who wins an election. The results stay the same. Our living standards continue to decline. This is a fact. And I think that's more of an issue that you all should be talking about instead of this whole supporting this whole fascist government that we have and have had for a few decades now.
Okay. Why do you call this a fascist government?
Well, because we have a partnership between Washington and corporate America, and the corporate interests are all that matters. This is why jobs are going overseas. That's kind of the definition of fascism, as Mussolini defined it, right? A partnership between corporations and Washington. These are facts. I'm actually a world expert on these issues, and I can verify all of these things. It's quite obvious to me. I only voted for one president in my life, and it was Ross Perot, the same man who warned about free trade. And we see what it has done. It destroyed this country.
Well, we appreciate all points on this show. Al, Ralph, do you have any comments on this?
My first comment is destroyed the country. Come on, that's let me be kind. That's premature.
I challenge you to take a look at the data and what's happened over the past three decades to this country. And I think that if you were well versed in the data and all of these issues instead of the politics, you would see we have been facing. It's been 10 years without an increase in median real wages. For instance, just 10 years, no increase in median real wages. Look at the income and wealth disparity; it's never been higher since the Great Depression. I mean, it's unbelievable. And the media is being used to fool people.
And assuming that all of that is true, it doesn't amount to ruining the country. That's
it does. Right? Look around. Maybe not for you. Maybe you're doing fine. But look around. We have 42 million Americans on food stamps. My dad.
42 million Americans. Sir, caller. Let the Congressman Al respond.
My dad was a truck driver. My brother and I are doing much better than he did. This country has moved the middle class up big. Lately, I think we've run into, and here I'm going to be partisan, we've run into too many ultra-conservative policies that have moved that back. But to say the country is ruined is extreme.
This country's not only ruined, it's finished for the future. You have moved up. I have moved up. But our kids are not going to move up. That's the problem.
We're
done with the glory days.
Caller, we appreciate your calling in, and we hope that you'll keep listening to us. We appreciate that. I mean, Al, caller brings up several points. You know, cost of living adjustments have been taken down in many instances. There's people saying that Social Security is an issue. How do you respond to those kind of statements from that side of the electorate?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Or you're asking him?
Hmm. Well, the question's for you. How does you, as a former member of Congress, how do you respond to somebody who truly believes that the country's ruined?
Well, that's kind of like asking, how do you conclude that 2 and 2 make 4? I think that we're going through a difficult time economically. We are not long from having a fabulous economy under Bill Clinton, and I think that if you pick points in our history where we were in a trough. The Civil War, for example, then I think you could always say something like, we're ruined. But the fact is, we've survived two world wars, we've survived a terrible recession, we've survived, and I think that saying it's all over, let's all go to Canada, is just ridiculous. I think it is not all over. That is not to say that many of the points the gentleman makes aren't true. It's his conclusion that I am arguing with. This country is not done.
And Al and Ralph, you know, we get, hopefully as we expand the show and the show starts getting new listeners, we're going to have listeners that are going to go on various extremes. I guess the question is, that's what the whole basis of the First Congress Society is about, is we can hear civil discourse, we can have civil discourse, but we don't necessarily have to agree, but it doesn't mean we have to start making any quick jumps to conclusions or start name-calling. Would you agree with that?
Well, and I would make the point that the caller was perfectly civil. He didn't do any name-calling.
No.
He said something I didn't agree with. But he laid out his argument. He laid out some facts to go along with it. He didn't call names, and he didn't jump up and down and scream and shout and beller.
Right.
It was a perfectly civil presentation of a point of view that I don't happen to agree with.
Right. Ralph, we've got another caller. Caller from the 214 area code. You're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Yes. I'd like to follow up, actually, on the comment, if I could.
Yes.
I would like to ask the congressman to get a copy of America's Financial Apocalypse, written in 2006, which predicted everything in detail, including the bailout of Fannie and Freddie, Dow 6000, the collapse in real estate, the healthcare tsunami, the entitlement tsunami, everything. And it shows you that how it's been mismanaged this country for 30 years. The second thing I'd like to address is that you mentioned Clinton's our booming economy in the Clinton years. That was all a bubble economy. If you read that book, the extended version, you will see all of that. This is my business of research. I know this stuff. And I'm not happy about it. You think I'm happy to conclude that we're in a finished nation? I'm not happy about that. I want things to improve for this country.
I didn't think you sounded happy about it.
Well, I understand, but I'm just saying that, not you, but I'm saying that I just wanted to clarify, this is not something that I'm happy to state. I don't want this for my country.
Let Congressman Al continue for a second.
I would just like you to repeat the reference you made so that listeners might want to write it down in case they'd like to follow up on you.
Yes, Congressman, it's America's financial apocalypse. And I would also like to state that the media has blackballed me ever since then. I uncovered the Washington Mutual fraud through the SEC. They won't talk about it. There's massive fraud going on in this country, and they've shut people like me up. I was interviewed by the FCIC by phone, and once they heard that I wanted to address the accountability issues, they decided not to invite me up to Washington.
No.
You can reference me. You can look me up, and you will see this.
Caller, I have a question for you. You made a statement, and by the way, we've only got 4 minutes left in the show. Caller, you made a statement that you're an expert on these issues. And you don't have to give details. Obviously, you're anonymous on the show right now. Are you a former public servant, or have you done public service, worked for the government before?
I have not worked for the government, nor would I ever, because we have a mafia in this country, and it needs to be broken up. Our country is controlled by Israel and the Zionist organizations, and this is why we are in wars. We have no business overseas.
Okay.
We need to work on the people in this country. People are suffering in this country, and it's about
time we
stop all this.
We're up against the call. Thanks again. You're welcome to call again. Thank you.
This is a good point to refer to Taylor's first law.
Yes, exactly. I'm not gonna deal with. And again, you know, he was fine until he started with and those type of terms. When he started making accusations of fraud, I can't. You know what? I'm not an expert. I can't prove it. You're a former member of Congress. I mean, we have a PhD doctorate here with us in Ralph. We can't make those determinations unless somebody shows me proof, and then again, prove innocent until proven guilty. I just don't see it. Al, am I wrong in this?
Well, look, this is a program of opinion. He expressed his opinion. I thought he expressed it very articulately. He gave us some information that we can look into if we wish to.
Absolutely.
So I see nothing wrong with the caller except his conclusion.
I think what the callers need to understand is we are living in an increasingly globalized society. We have to compete with China, Russia, India, Israel. We never had to do that in years past. And we're not able to compete because of our economic policies. Borrow too much money. We're asking countries like to fund our debt. And until we start promoting job growth, until we start promoting small business in this country, we're going to be at a real disadvantage.
Right.
There are a lot of companies in China want to come to the U.S. They want to trade with us because we have traditionally had a very positive viewpoint in China.
Right.
And China helped them, Japanese, who are perceived as very honest people. But when we start sticking at them on trade and get very scared, concerned about the Wi-Fi business because of the perception.
We've got 1 minute. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour, or the top of the hour at 6 o'clock. We've got a minute left. Al, Ralph, thank you again. Great show as always. To our callers, I want to say thank you very much. We hope that you'll continue to stay with us. But for now, this is Backroom Politics signing off from Florida, Hawaii, and Al's still holding down the fort. And
I still got my martini.
Before we leave, and Al's going to get a martini. Folks, happy Thanksgiving. Safe and happy holiday to everybody. Travel safe if you're traveling. And then please Stay with us. We'll be live from Shelley's Back Room next week. This is J.T. Russell for Al Swift and Ralph Winnie. Goodbye from Florida.